Welcome to Opus Private Clients Wealth Style Podcast. All of the material discussed on our podcasts have specific themes, and that's to move your wealth and lifestyle forward, increase your purpose, and provide you with clarity and confidence. Opus's mantra is always forward. We have found that regardless of one's wealth, moving your lifestyle forward is the number one priority for our clients. On our podcast, we'll share our rich 35 years of experience in designing strategies, share clients' experiences, and introduce resources that have positively impacted our clients. We trust that you will enjoy our direct, transparent, and realistic approach to positively impacting the quality of you and your family's lives. Now, on to the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Opus Wealth Style Podcast. My name is Ivan Watanabe here with my partner, Evan Wall. Evan, what's going on, man? How are you?
Doing great. How are you? What's going on?
I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. We're very excited today to have on again, Stephanie Roden from Roden Legal PC, a great resource for us and our clients. And again, Stephanie, we're excited to have you back on.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you both for having me. It's always fun talking to you guys. So thanks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Stephanie, for those that weren't able to see the first episode, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your practice, kind of what you're focused on, and we'll take it from there.
Sure. So I'm an attorney that focuses on working with healthcare practitioners across the tri-state area and Florida. We work with them on the business management of their practices. So we don't do any litigation, but we work with them on employment agreements, on patient issues, employee issues, the buy and sell of practices, their consent forms, everything about the running of their practices. I've been doing this for close to 24 years at this point. I come from a family of doctors, so I've literally been around it my entire life. So I understand the pressures of healthcare, what gets involved, the schooling and the education that they go through as far as like regular medical or dental school, the residencies, the fellowships and everything else. So when we work with our clients, we really try to focus on them, their specialty, making sure that the contracts accurately reflect what it is that they're doing and to protect them. So this way, when they decide to leave, because let's be honest, no one stays in their first job anymore. Everyone is always moving around or opening up their own practice. They have to be able to do what they want to do. And if the contract doesn't have the language to protect them, that can really get in the way. So it's our job to make sure that they have that option and that opportunity when they so desire it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, I know you had read through my wife's contract offers. Again, Joanna's an anesthesiologist. And so a lot of the terms and the risks and the things in the contract, like we weren't aware of, didn't understand, didn't even know what to look for. So I think having your help with those things in particular was extremely valuable. And oftentimes when we're having conversations with clients that are finishing residency or fellowship, they're just excited to get offers, right? It's like they're at the light at the end of the tunnel. They're finally there. They're just like, I want to work here. I don't even know what the numbers look like. It's just significantly more than what I was making before. There's no conversation about the contract. And so we have to kind of invite them to say like, all right, but let's read through this carefully, right? And understand it.
It's funny. So definitely before COVID, I gave more seminars to the resident departments across the hospitals than I do now. But the ones that I do now, or even the physicians or dentists that I talk to that are just starting, they are so excited to just start their career and actually be making money and doing what they've gone to school for, that they don't really pay attention, as they shouldn't, because they're not trained in it, right, to like the language of the contract. And many times a client will contact me and say, I read through the contract. It seems fine to me, but you know, I was told I need to have an attorney look at it just to make sure that I'm protected. So can you look at it? And then I'll look at it. And then we send an email that has like 15, 20 points of things that we found. And they're like, oh my God, I never would have thought of this. And it's like, well, that's why we're here. You are specialist in the field that you were educated in. And that's why you hire the attorneys to see the things that you can't see. And they're always so shocked over it because they weren't expecting such a long list of things that we would want to change on their behalf to better protect them. They're like, oh, I didn't even think of that. I'm like, Definitely. Yeah.
The ones that kind of hit me directly. So I give presentations to different residency groups and fellowship groups. And the ones that kind of hit me when we were reviewing Joanna's, the first one was tail coverage, like in the nuances of tail coverage. So for those that aren't familiar or this is their first time kind of hearing about it, can you just explain a little bit more about what tail coverage is, kind of how it works, and then what they should be thinking about?
Absolutely. So just to be clear, so I did defense malpractice work for close to 10 years or so before I opened up my own practice. So I know how devastating it can be if you don't have coverage and you get sued, because you never want to spend your own money on legal fees, attorney's fees, verdict or settlement. So you always want to make sure you have coverage. And this is incredibly important for all fields, but specifically for healthcare because of the increase in litigation against them. The easiest way to explain it is to give a fact pattern. Okay, so let's just say you start working at a practice in 2024, you treat a patient in 2025, and then for whatever reason, you decide to leave in 2026, no longer affiliated with the practice. And a patient that you worked on in 2025 sues you for alleged malpractice in 2027 within the statute of limitations. For those of you, the statute of limitations is the time period that a patient can bring a claim against a physician. And that's typically 2.5 years from the last date of treatment. There are some exceptions, but that's the overall rule. The question is, when this patient brought this claim against you, do you have coverage? Because again, you never want to be without coverage. If you had an occurrence policy, which is more expensive, that means that you had coverage at the time of the occurrence, the time that the treatment was rendered. So it doesn't matter if you're no longer with the practice. It doesn't matter if you've left the practice. You will always have coverage because it's automatic as to the time that you provided the services. Now, using that same fact pattern, if it's a claims made policy, it means just that, when the claim was made against you, which in our fact pattern was in 2027.
Seven, I think.
Lost track of that for a second. So then the question is, okay, so what happened? To have claims made policies, you need to get tail insurance at the time that you leave your job. And the tail coverage converts claims made policies into occurrence policies. Now, if you are still practicing with the firm, you don't need tail coverage because the policy is still active. The only time tail coverage comes into play is when the policy is canceled or terminated, that you need to make sure that you have continued coverage for the time of the services that you rendered in order to protect you for future claims that may be made against you for those prior services. And that's what the tail coverage is. So typically the tail coverage is going to be for about 3 years, give or take, depending upon the field. If you're in pediatrics, it's going to be longer because they're minors. I mean, there's a lot of little technicalities which brokers can go into, but you always want to make sure that you got the tail coverage. And with practices, occurrence policies are much more expensive. So they may not want to pay for it. So they may automatically get claims made and push the tail coverage onto the individual physician should they leave, to be like, well, you decided to leave. It's now your responsibility to pay for the tail coverage. And then depending upon the number of years that they've been practicing, the specialty that they're in, how many prior claims by patients they may have against them will determine the amount of the tail coverage. You know, I've had some clients that left and didn't realize they would be responsible for tail coverage, and I worked with them on it, and they're paying upwards of $80,000, $90,000 for tail coverage. And they have to pay that more or less in a lump sum within 30 days, otherwise they don't have coverage. So it can be an extreme amount of money. And understanding this when you're reviewing the contract, knowing whether you're responsible for it or not, is imperative, because that's an extra expense you have to think about if you ever think about leaving. One of the things that our firm works on is trying to not have them pay for tail coverage, obviously, and trying to get it covered by the employer, or coming up with a compromise that maybe it gets split, or maybe if they're there for a certain period of time, it then gets covered by the employer, like certain incentives. It just depends upon the employer, how big the employer is, the sophistication of how long they've been in practice working with attorneys, that really determines what that may be.
Yeah. Are you seeing a majority of physicians having their tail coverage or some sort of negotiating tactic in smaller practices, or are you seeing this in like large national private equity firms that are coming in buying different practices? Like, where do you see more sort of leverage on the physician side? Or is there no consistency?
There is absolutely no consistency. The one thing I will say is that for every institution, hospitals, clinics, things like that, it's almost always occurrence or self-insured. So they never have to worry about tail coverage. So if you're joining, because the hospitals don't want to risk that, obviously, because for any procedure that's done in a hospital, the hospital is always going to be part of a lawsuit. So they never want to risk anything. So there is always occurrence, and none of the clients ever have to worry about that at all. It's when you start going into the smaller practices, and it depends upon the specialty. There are some small practices, let's say in derm, but they'll give you an occurrence policy because they know how important it is and so much can happen. Same thing with OBGYN. It really depends upon more the specialty and really the size and how long they've been out. If the practice, even if they're small, is making a lot of money, they're probably going to end up covering it because it's a risk for them not to have it. There are certain requirements that they may cover it, but it's not an automatic. And if the physician meets those requirements, then it's fine. So it just really sort of depends on what it is.
The idea there would be, if I'm planning on leaving X, Y, and Z employer, I need to pick up this coverage before my separation date of this, an ideal scenario, before I stop working there. Is that right?
No, because you still have the coverage from the practice. So you have to get it within 30 days of leaving. So you typically don't get it before. Again, the contracts may have language that indicates if, you know, you don't purchase it, the practice may purchase it on your behalf again, because it will benefit them, but then you have to reimburse the practice. So there could be some type of payment plan, maybe, that you can go into at the time of termination with the practice that you're working at, because you may not have the money to cover it and they'll cover it, but you're paying them as opposed to paying the actual carrier for the tail coverage. So it's always a negotiation factor at the time, but it is something that you want to be aware of from the beginning when you're looking into the contract.
Stephanie, over the last few years, maybe since COVID, have you seen any big shifts in the market as it relates to purchasing a practice or starting their own practice? Especially, I'm curious, with interest rates being much higher, wonder what kind of changes you're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, now that we're, you know, a good number of years since COVID, it's probably, with the exception of the increase in interest rates, it's probably the same. When it was much closer to the time of COVID, most of the agreements were having language added in about changes in patient numbers, changes in revenue as a result of COVID, because they weren't working for X number of years. Some patients still didn't come back in time. So I would say probably by like the end of 22, beginning of 23, things for purchases started to look almost the same. The big difference that I found that people are now, people being attorneys are now starting to shy away from and removing from contracts is this force majeure clause, which typically was only in commercial leases, which basically indicates that if there is an act of God, terrorism, epidemics, pandemics, tornadoes, hurricanes, like something that no one has any control over that prevents the practice from continuing to practice or prevents the physician from being able to provide services, that no one will be held at fault and the practice could stop payment or decrease payment according to the contract in order to survive. Now, I'm summarizing it, obviously. Those clauses were almost automatically added into every contract after COVID. I added them into my contracts, and most contracts I saw, they added it in. They still exist, but there's now sort of a trend I'm noticing that counsel, when I'm talking to them, they're like, you know what, we can just remove it. So they're not as adamant about keeping them in as much as they were before. I personally still like them in because you never know what can happen since it's happened before. But there, it's that was something that changed within the contracts for across the board, all types of contracts.
What about volume? Are you seeing just more or less or kind of about the same in terms of buying into a practice? Does that ebb and flow or stays pretty steady?
For me, it's been fairly steady. I would say it's been steadier on the dental side than it was on the physician side. That I have no explanation for. I don't know if it's because of COVID. At the time of COVID, if you think about it, they're in very close proximity to the mouth and to a lot of bacteria and things that the older generation took it as a reason to retire. You know, and it could have been something along those lines as opposed to like physicians. But now I think across the board, it's been fine. There are certain fields that really don't sell, nor do they have their own individual practices. They're normally linked with a hospital. That may be the difference also with dentistry as opposed to physicians, because physicians typically are linked with hospitals or hospitals buy out the practices.
Yeah, I'm certainly not the only one, but there seems to be a major shift in large practices, large hospital groups, large private equity firms coming in and buying other practices, right? It's pretty significant out there. How has that changed or impacted something like non-competes, right? where I'm working at a particular hospital, and by the time I'm ready to leave, the hospital has since been acquired, and it's now acquired three other hospitals that are 30 miles away. How have you seen that kind of impacted? And then what's your general recommendation to folks to deal with that in their contracts?
Yeah. So the non-compete is really the only area that has been any type of change, really, since my last time being on here. You may remember that there was a bill in front of the governor of New York to abolish the non-competes in these agreements that she was slated to sign at the end of last year, but she didn't. So they still exist. They're still enforceable so long as they meet the court prong test. But there are some institutions, the larger that they are, that they're starting to shy away a little bit from the non-competes, understanding that they're probably going to be abolished at some point in the near future. So they're keeping the non-competes on the smaller side. When you deal with the sale of a practice or an institution and the third party comes in, whether it's private equity, whether it's just another hospital, whatever, whoever that may be, typically all of the employment agreements get updated. And most of the physicians need to sign a new employment agreement because it's now owned by someone new and they have to acknowledge that they are now the owners of it. So, and obviously the physicians aren't privy to the actual sale contract, so they don't know what the terms are. But typically in the majority of sales contracts, the ones that I draft and the ones that I review, definitely, they have language that indicates that the non-competes will apply to the employees or based upon what was in existence at the time of the sale. So this way, the new employer, the new owner, whoever it may be, still is allowed to go to enforce the non-compete against these physicians who may not sign a new contract. So let's say, for an example, I'm a physician working at, I don't know, NYU, let's just say, since they're a big conglomerate, and let's say that they sell to Northwell, another big conglomerate, and I decide I don't want to be a part of Northwell for whatever reason. Basically, what would happen is that if I leave, I've never signed a Northwell contract, but Northwell will still be able to enforce whatever non-compete I had in my NYU contract, because that's generally going to be part of the sale agreement. Because if they can't enforce it, then that sale is going to be worth nothing. If physicians leave because they don't want to go with whatever new third party is. And I'm just using NYU and Northwell. There is no deal or anything else on the table. And I want that to be clear. I am not releasing any type of attorney-client privilege in any which way. However, as the example, that's sort of what it is. The other thing that I have found is that with private equity, a lot of the physicians don't understand the way that works, because private equity is not allowed to own practices outright. Private equity isn't owned by physicians. They're normally owned by non-licensed individuals. And what private equity does is they have what's called MSOs, the management service organizations, that take over the non-clinical part of the practices. And then there's a practice that takes over the practice, or the practice continues to provide that. So when I speak to my clients and they're like, I'm confused, what is private equity doing? And it's like, well, it's not necessarily the pure goodwill of it, but they're taking over non-clinical issues, the advertising, the marketing, the leases, the insurance, the non-clinical staff, equipment, supplies, materials, instruments, like all this other stuff, right? And they, especially in New York, they're not allowed to actually share in the profits of the actual medical practice. And the medical practice still is in control of the fees, in control of the licensed individuals, is in control of the patient records. So there is a split, and a lot of people don't understand this. And the contracts are very convoluted, makes it sound like they're not clear. It's just they're very intricate, and there's a lot of them. And these deals take a very long time because of it. And there is a lot of money that goes back and forth. They are very difficult to go through. They could be incredibly beneficial for both parties. It's just making sure that the language is correct and that follows the rule of the law based upon the state of where they're at.
That's super helpful. I was curious on your feedback. So I've got a client who is purchasing an equity stake in a surgical practice. And so we were kind of talking a little bit about how the valuation was going to come about, and obviously basing it off of EBITDA and sort of walking through just general financials. But one of the things I talked to him about, and I'm curious how often you see this or don't see this, one of the things I was talking to him about was, okay, well, what happens if this new partner of yours dies? What happens if this new partner of yours gets disabled? What happens if this new partner of yours gets divorced? Are you building it into the contract? Are you purchasing insurance policies as a result of that? Are you collaterally assigning some of the policies? Like, how often do you see something like that? And do you generally recommend that people explore those options when they're buying into a practice?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's one of the things that we look for. So it may not go into the actual sale agreement, but it would go into, so let's say that the legal entity, so dealing with New York, you have two choices for legal entities for licensed individuals. So it's professional corporation PCs and the professional limited liability companies, the PLLCs. So when you're doing a sale agreement, you're also updating the legal documents of the actual legal entity. So you would be updating the bylaws, or you'd be updating like the shareholder agreements, right? Or you'd be updating the operating agreement. And within those agreements, you would absolutely have language about what happens if there's death, retirement, temporary or permanent disability. Are you taking out key man insurance or life insurance policies out on the partners? How does it work? What's the payment? How, because if you think about it, if you don't have some type of life insurance policy and the practice has a death of one of its partners and they have to pay off the estate, where are they getting that money from? Mm-hmm. That can cause the practice to go under, depending upon the value of the practice, depending upon the percentage of interest that deceased owner may have owned. So you want to have that language in there at the time of purchase of any percentage of interest of any type of practice. It's the only way to really protect yourself. And it should be in there, and you should have in their language about retirement and what's considered the retirement age, not just what happens at retirement, but, you know, when can someone actually give notice about retirement? How much notice do they have to give the practice that they're looking to retire at X age so that the practice can start to put things in place in order to protect itself at the time of the retirement? So timing of everything is also really important, not just what happens when, but how much notice do you have to give if you're able to give notice?
Yeah, that's extremely helpful. Are there any other changes or updates or things that you find pretty common in your conversation with clients that you want to kind of make sure that the audience takes away, or something that has been sort of popping up recently for you?
I would say more often than not, especially for clients of mine who are moving from job to job, they're not just newer physicians or dentists, and they're looking to join a new practice in the hopes of becoming a partner. There should be language in those employment agreements, and there should be very specific language of what happens if partnership doesn't happen, right? Because if you're going into these conversations of, you've been working for 5 years as a cardiologist, you're now joining another firm in the hopes of becoming part of that firm, you want there to be language that says, okay, after X number of years or X number of months, we're going to go into discussions about partnership. And then what does that look like? Is there going to be another agreement? You're never going to get too much information in the employment agreements, but you want that in there that gives you the right to have it. And if you don't, then the practice is under no obligation to even have the discussion with you. You know, although there's no guarantee of partnership, there should be something in there about the requirements of becoming a partner that you can start to have the conversations.
Yeah.
And this is helpful.
Set the expectation early.
Exactly. And so this is helpful for the physicians, because one, it gives them the incentive. Two, they have an understanding of what it is, and they know that they left their other job to join this one, knowing that will probably happen. And if it doesn't happen, then they can leave. And maybe there's language in there that says mm-hmm. they don't become partner for reasons that the, let's say the practice doesn't offer to them. Maybe the non-compete doesn't apply. Yep. Maybe you can use that as a negotiation tactic. If the sole purpose was to join them for a year, have partnership conversation, and by 18 months, you're a partner. And if it doesn't happen, why would you want to stay somewhere if you're not going to be a partner? So you want those conversations. And this is more with the clients that have been working for a longer period of time. They have a following. They have much more to offer. And we're not talking about the newer physicians, yeah. But it is something that you still want to consider when you're moving from job to job, if that's your goal.
Absolutely. This has been super helpful. Again, to reiterate some of the things that we talked about in the past, it's always a good refresher for me. Any other things, anything else before we kind of end the conversation that you want to make sure that the audience takes away?
Make sure you understand whatever document you are signing before you sign. That's all I have to say, because I can sit there and talk to my clients and tell them XYZ and they sign. But once you sign, you're going to be held to that language. So, and this goes for any type of contract, you should just always have an understanding. And if you're working with an attorney, regardless of what document it is, and you don't understand something, make sure you ask the attorney to explain it to you so that you have full knowledge. That's the only thing I can stress, because once you sign, you are bound by the terms of the agreements and you're never going to be able to get out of it.
Yeah. Love it. Appreciate it. And Stephanie, where can the listening audience find out a little bit more about you, your practice, and if they wanted to contact you to have you review their contracts, where can they find you?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find out information about my firm at rodinlegal.com. It has a lot of information in there. You can sign up to have, you know, information about my newsletter. I have a podcast also called Speaking with Steph that really discusses some legal issues. It also does something similar to what you guys do in the sense of talking to people. And there's just certain ways of going around it. You can always email at info@rodinlegal.com if you want to get more information. If, you know, anyone who's listening, they're like, oh, I have a dire question. I am always happy to guide and to help in any way that I can to make sure that they have the knowledge that they can make an informed decision of what their next move is in their career.
Appreciate it. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us again. We really appreciate it. It's always lovely to see you. And thank you to the listening audience for tuning in. And make sure to click subscribe below to be notified when we release our next podcast episode. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Style Podcast. Click the subscribe button below to be notified when new episodes become available.
This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and is for general public use. Guest speakers and their firms are not affiliated with or endorsed by PAS, Guardian, or Opus Private Client, and opinions stated are their own. This material is provided for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal advice. Please contact your legal advisor regarding your individual situation. Guardian, its subsidiaries, agents, and employees do not provide legal advice. Yvonne Watanabe and Evan Wall are registered representatives and financial advisors of Park Avenue Securities, LLC, PAS. Securities products and advisory services offered through PAS member FINRA SIPC. Financial representatives of the Guardian Life Insurance Company of America, Guardian, New York, New York. PAS is a wholly owned subsidiary of Guardian. Opus Private Client, LLC, is not an affiliate or subsidiary of PAS or Guardian. Opus Private Client, LLC, is not registered in any state or with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission as a registered investment advisor. Yvonne's California Insurance License Number, 0H44206. Evan's California Insurance Number, 0H04936. Compliance Approval 2024-170297 expires March 2026.